Well, welcome back to the Bill Bennett Show post-Thanksgiving. It's the podcast that translates Trump. We take an honest look at the current administration, and we take a look at the things that matter most to American Americans. We look at the existential threats to our country, both at home and abroad. Joining me today is Mark Krikorian, the Executive Director of the Center for Immigration Studies. He's the pro. He's the guy who knows. We'll get his thoughts on what's happening at the southern border, federal judges' block of the president's asylum ban. What does this all mean? Where do we go from here? And, of course, we'll update the fact of this rush at the border. Also, Brian Kennedy joins the show. He is the president of the American Strategy Group. Brian has a depth of knowledge regarding the existential threats to America coming from abroad. We'll talk about the Khashoggi killing, the upcoming G2 summit, and this caravan at the border. Just a note here, as you listen to Mark Krikorian, we pre-recorded this last week, Thanksgiving week. This was before the rush on the border that members of the caravan did at the Tijuana-San Ysidro border. So we don't talk directly to Mark about that. His general points, I think, all apply. The only difference, I believe, is that the president does have this power under national security, which he is the arbiter almost exclusively, to close the border. And as I have been saying in a couple of TV interviews and elsewhere, we have closed the border before. We closed it in the mid-80s, the time of Kiki Camarena, the DEA agent who was murdered. Ronald Reagan closed the border. We also did it in 9/11, Claude, closed the border, and nobody got in and nothing got in. No drugs got in, nobody got in, nothing got in. So the president can do this. That, I think, is the only thing I'd add to the Mark Krikorian interview, which is coming up now.
You're listening to The Bill Bennett Show. Bill Bennett
Show. Well, let's welcome Mark Krikorian to the show, the executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies. Mark, we've had this federal judge ruling about the caravan and then the president's response. Where are we?
Well, the caravan, you know, a big part of it, more than half of it, has actually reached Tijuana. Some people peeled off along the way and took up Mexico's offer for asylum in Mexico, which is really what they should be doing if they really were seeking asylum. But most of them said, no, they're going to keep going. They went to Tijuana, which is 1,000 miles farther than Texas, which would have been the closer place, partly because I think they thought it was safer, and probably mainly because it's in the Ninth Circuit, or California's in the Ninth Circuit, and so
Wow, really?
Oh, they're advised. You know, the whole thing is not some George Soros operation or anything, but they're clearly being advised by immigration lawyers and anti-borders activists.
I just want to pause there. So Texas is tougher, and if you go to California, you'll be under the protection, if you will, of the Ninth Circuit.
Yeah, exactly. If there's, you know, lawsuits and stuff to be to happen. And so now they're in Tijuana. All along Mexico, everywhere they stopped, they were basically greeted warmly, and people brought out water and food and all that kind of stuff because they were only going to be there one night. So everybody had a little party, a little bit of excitement in your small town, and then they moved on. Well, Tijuana's the end of the line as far as Mexico goes. And even the ones who are lining up at the ports of entry to apply for asylum are going to end up, you know, having to take a number, and they're going to be waiting there for days or weeks. The people in Tijuana are none too happy about this. There were protests over the weekend by local Tijuana people saying, you know, this is an invasion and these people are taking over. They're camping on the beach and they didn't like it at all. In fact, to the extent that the mayor of Tijuana was out there protesting with a red baseball cap that said, "Make Tijuana great again."
Really?
God. I'm surprised that picture wasn't everywhere. News media spiked that.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. No kidding.
And it's a real picture. It wasn't some, you know, Photoshop thing or, you know, Alex Jones cooking up some phony baloney thing. It was a real picture from Mexican media, which then, you know, a few people picked up. So my point is, people in Tijuana aren't happy about this. But especially with this ruling from the judge, which is just one more example of, without getting into the weeds, it's one more example of the law doesn't count as long as it's Trump trying to use it. I mean, this is a resistance jurisprudence. But the fact is, most of these people anyway were not going to sneak across the border and then apply for asylum, which is what this ruling was about. Most of them, even before the ruling, were going to line up at the port of entry. And when they get to the head of the line, say to the immigration inspector the magic words that they've been coached to say. And, maybe they'd have to wait a few days, a couple weeks for their number to come up for an initial interview. But they're going to end up being led into the United States, and we're never going to see him again. And the problem here is not that the executive branch is not being energetic or imaginative enough. The problem is the statute itself, the laws themselves, have significant loopholes. Congress has not appropriated enough money for detention space. And the result is the administration is going to end up having to let most of these people in, and they're going to disappear, and the Democrats are okay with that.
Now, let's just review that quickly, because the federal judge, his name is Tiger, Judge Tiger, said, you know, the law is perfectly clear, and they're entitled to make the claim of asylum and get it. The White House responded, White House lawyers responded, and I think Homeland Security responded saying, no, we have sufficient legal authority under 1182 or whatever it is, I can't remember, and other statutes to prevent this from happening. Are they right as well?
No, well, the judge is simply wrong on this. We have an analysis on our homepage by a former immigration judge and Hill staffer.
We'll put a link to it, but go ahead, describe it briefly to us.
Basically, I mean, the judge just isn't familiar with immigration law. I mean, that's kind of what it amounts to. Anybody can apply for asylum. I mean, Osama bin Laden, if he were alive, could say, I want to apply for asylum. It doesn't mean you're eligible for it. What the administration said is that people who sneak across the border are not eligible for asylum. And the statute is pretty clear on this. It says anybody, even if you sneak across the border, you can apply for asylum, but you're not eligible for it if you're a terrorist or a persecutor, or if there are other regulations issued by the Attorney General or DHS. And that's exactly what the Justice Department did, is they issued regulation saying that, you know, you're not eligible for asylum. I mean, it's cut and dry.
Do they have to give a rationale for why you're not in the national interest or in the interest of...
Because what they did is it's an emergency regulation that goes into effect immediately rather than waiting for the period of notice and comment, they call it, when you make a rule. And so the judge said their rationale for the immediate effectiveness of that ruling wasn't sound when... It was. I mean, this is not a stretch. This is not some, you know, implausible thing. This is pretty cut and dry. No, for instance, what the administration said is they had to issue this rule up front, have it be effective immediately, and then have the period of, you know, public comment afterwards, because if they did it the other way around, then the illegal immigrants would know that they had, you know, 60 days, 90 days or whatever to rush through before the new rule went into effect. And the judge said, oh, that's absurd. How would an illegal immigrant in Mexico know about that? I mean, that's just willfully absurd, because these people are being coached by immigration lawyers, American immigration lawyers, who know perfectly well what the situation is, and they're advising and coaching these illegal immigrants on what to say and where to go and how to do it. So, I mean, the judge is, you know, either clueless or just willfully not telling the truth.
All right. So the president has legal authority to prevent them from coming over.
No. He has the authority to prevent them, make them ineligible for asylum.
Okay.
But there are other statuses they can apply for. You know, something called withholding of removal or a protection under the Convention Against Torture. It's just that the threshold is higher. The bar is higher for those. They're less likely to get those.
Let me reframe it. The president has the authority to act so that we do not have to see, we will not see or may not see a massive influx of people.
No. I don't think so.
Okay.
No. And the problem there is the loopholes in the law, because if somebody applies at a port of entry, which is not what this ruling was about, in other words, a regular crossing point, they stand in line, wait to meet the immigration inspector, and they utter the magic words that they've been coached to say, we have to give them an interview. It's like a preliminary interview, and they're already in the United States at that point. I mean, our immigration inspectors are 20, 30 yards inside the U.S. Once you're there, then what do we do with you? Mexico doesn't have to take you back. This is a serious problem that we're now, you know, we're only now facing, which is one of the reasons we need to be working with Mexico on this and making sure that we have an arrangement with them where a third country person who comes through, we can send back. They don't want to do that. And frankly, if we're insulting them, we spend 2 years insulting them, they're not likely to play ball with us, you know?
All right, but I just want to follow up with that point then. So this business about, well, here comes the Fifth Circuit, Ninth Circuit, and then we'll get the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will decide with us. Maybe not.
It probably will decide. I mean,
with the president?
Yeah, probably will side with the president on this specific issue. But number one, that's going to take a while. It could be months. Who knows when that'll happen?
Okay.
And secondly, a lot of these people sneaking across the border and applying for asylum now will just, when they say the words, "I fear return" or whatever, they don't have to know that they can apply for these other statuses. It's kind of automatic that if they're ineligible for asylum, they're still potentially eligible under international law that we signed, treaties that we've signed, for other statuses. So my point is the administration is not going to be able to – they may be able to slow the process of this caravan, but because of loopholes in the law, they're not going to be able to stop it. It may take a few months longer for all these people to get in and then disappear as illegal immigrants in the U.S., but I think most of them are going to be able to do it.
Wow. So they're
I'm not enthusiastic about that. That's the way it's going to be.
So they're going to get in. They're going to get in, probably.
I think they're going to get in, and over the next 2 years, it's going to get worse because the Democrats are unwilling to do anything to protect the border. The plus side is that this is really going to raise this issue in sharp relief, that, you know, this is the Democrats do not want illegal immigrants from Central America to be kept out of the United States. I mean, that's really what it amounts to.
Is there any chance, and would there be any sense to the president engaging in an act of civil disobedience himself? We're going to stop him. I'm going to stop him. Okay, we'll take it to the courts. So I'm going to stop him.
Sort of Andrew Jackson style, you know, they ruled, now let them enforce it. Yeah,
that's right.
I mean, that's kind of my inclination. On the other hand, you know,
kind
then
of your inclination to recommend.
Yeah, well, it's my sort of gut reaction.
Yeah, me too.
On the other hand, you've then got individual officers who are then liable or who can be held in contempt of court, individual Border Patrol agents and stuff. You see what I mean? I don't know the mechanics of how that will work. At some point, somebody's going to have to challenge the judiciary because, you know, we increasingly simply don't live in a government of consent. We're not governed by consent of the governed. We're governed by lifetime judges, and that may have worked for being ruled by judges may have worked for the Israelites, you know, 3,000 years ago. It's not the way our Constitution is supposed to work. And so at some point, there's going to be a confrontation. I just don't know if this is the right place.
He has seemed as firm and resolute on this one, in this chapter, as we've ever seen him. Fair enough.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. The question is, when push comes to shove, what's he going to do?
What are the politics of it, you think?
I mean, this is clearly a 70-80% issue for the president. The problem is, because he's the president, a lot of Democrats are just against whatever he's for. It's really remarkable the radicalization of the mainstream left on immigration, even before Trump, but Trump really has supercharged it. I mean, if the guy said it was good to shower every day, they just stop showering. You know what I mean? And so if Trump wants to keep out illegal immigrants from Central America, then, you know, the left wants to let them in, if for no other reason than Trump wants to keep them out. I mean, that complicates the politics of it. That's the problem.
Wow.
I don't have a good answer. I mean, I think it's going to get a lot worse over the next 2 years.
So I was asking you what he ought to do, and you said you're tempted. I'm tempted to recommend that. But what do you think will happen? You think he'll just let it go?
He's not going to be able to. I mean, the opportunity he has now is in the lame duck session. And in the lame duck, my fear is, he may go for a DACA amnesty in exchange for wall money, funding for his wall. The problem is the wall thing isn't that relevant to this issue.
Yeah.
These, like I said, most of these people are lining up at legal crime
in the wall. Right.
It's the various loopholes that the president has talked about. I'm not saying they've ignored that. It's just that he's always prioritized the wall. He has an opportunity to, you know, force the issue and say he's going to veto a funding bill if it doesn't plug these loopholes.
I see.
The question is, that's a political issue. It's always, a government shutdown is always a political calculation. And would the Republicans win that kind of standoff? I think this issue is acute enough that they might be able to pull it off. But, you know, there's no reason. It's not a coincidence they're called the stupid party. So I'm not enthusiastic. I'm not optimistic that even if they went that route, they would succeed. But that's the one thing, I think, the one card the president does have to play.
You just used the word acute, and you've taught us that this caravan may be the acute problem, but it's the chronic problem is ongoing. Right.
Oh, absolutely, because we've got a caravan essentially kind of every day showing up at the border. In other words, not in this photogenic way, but there's people showing up every day, and all along the border, they bring a kid with them, they say the magic words, they're let in, and they disappear. You know, they may show up for a few of their hearings. Half of them never apply for asylum at all once they get past the border because they never intended to. They know they don't have a case. The other half do apply. But some of them, a lot of them, I would expect most of them apply because if your case drags on for 6 months, you get a work permit. And so once they get the work permit, hey, you know, they're home free and they can just keep going to hearings until the last hearing. Because it doesn't matter whether you've shown up for various hearings along the way. If you don't show up when you have been turned down, you get a letter saying you've been turned down for asylum, please show up on Tuesday with your luggage. If you don't do that, then it doesn't matter what hearings you came to in the meantime.
I got you.
You know what I mean?
Well, last question, we'll let you go. You started by talking about the people in Tijuana, Mexico, the mayor and so on, getting impatient with these people because they've been there a while. Are the people in San Diego equally impatient, or what is that town right at the bottom?
It doesn't seem to be the case, and part of the reason for that is, you know, San Diego is just the first stop for those
people. Stop along the way.
Some of them may stay. Stay there, but most of them will keep going to L.A., to Chicago, to Houston, to Washington D.C., whatever it is.
Got it.
See what I mean? So no, for San Diego, it's not a problem really.
I got They're bunched at Tijuana, but once they get across, they scatter all over the U.S.
Exactly.
Thank you, Mark. Goodness.
Okay, well, thank you.
We will be watching and getting back to you. We appreciate it always. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Bye.
You're listening to The Bill Bennett Show.
It's time to hear from Brian Kennedy. He is the president of the American Strategy Group. I'm proud to say I'm a fellow of the American Strategy Group here in Washington. Brian, Khashoggi, boy, they're tearing their hair out in Washington here, particularly in the press, about the gruesome killing. I think we can all agree, the gruesome killing and murder of Mr. Khashoggi, what about it? How should we think about this?
Well, I think the president was treating this with the kind of seriousness it deserved. On the other hand, he didn't get flustered by it, and he realizes the Saudis, the Saudi Arabians, are our allies, and that what are we going to do? Are we going to alienate ourselves from the Saudis? Are we going to invade Saudi Arabia? Are we going to end relations? And Trump just thinks all that's ridiculous because it would be. And he is asking people to have a, I don't want to use the word mature, but an informed and realistic view of how to deal with such a bad part of the world. You know, I've just written a piece, not been published yet, but the point of it is the Saudis were part and parcel of September 11th. 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi Arabians. It's almost inconceivable that they didn't achieve all that without the help of somebody from Saudi intelligence. And yet we didn't invade Saudi Arabia. We left them in power, and we said to them, don't do that again, and you're going to help us clean up Islamic terrorism in the Middle East. And for the past 20 years, they've done not a perfect job, but they've done a lot of that. And so now when they get rid of Khashoggi, however gruesome it may be, what were we expecting them to do? Khashoggi was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood who was trying to overthrow the Saudi regime. He was encouraging people to overthrow Egypt. And from a purely pro-American, pro-Western point of view, none of that was in our interest. So Khashoggi looks to be a bad actor. He wasn't a journalist. The Washington Post can put him in a baseball cap and act like he's a journalist, but doesn't appear that way. He was a man with opinions. He had been intimate with Saudi intelligence for many years himself. And then when the power structure of Saudi Arabia changed, his allegiances changed. The guy was an operator. Now, again, that doesn't justify him being killed in that gruesome way. But you know, when I look at, when I hear Republicans like Mitt Romney and Ben Sasse being hyperbolic about this, I just don't think they're being serious.
Three quick comments. One, just on your last, Corker and Flake may be gone, but Romney's coming in, and Sasse will, I expect, fill some of the shoes of Flake. So he's not, the president's not done with that kind of irritant, that kind of crowd noise from those two. Second, I hadn't heard this put quite that way before. Maybe I'm jumping ahead, but the comparison of the gruesome killing of Khashoggi with the 9/11 attack, which you said, you know, somebody in Saudi Arabia knew about, somebody in intelligence or somewhere. My God, if we wouldn't retaliate against them for that, you know, why would we retaliate against them for this? I mean, that was far more serious, far more consequential. And, you know, literally an attack on the United States and its citizens. You're right. We just told them to straighten up and behave themselves and work with us. Imperfect world. They are allies in this imperfect world against some worse people, correct?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And we expected them to do the kind of things in their own country and in that part of the world that we didn't want to do ourselves. And frankly, I don't think we should be surprised that this kind of thing goes on. And so one looks for the political ramifications of all this and the political design of all this. Why has such a big deal been made of all this? And it appears merely to weaken, you know, Saudi Arabia, weaken the alliance with the United States, and to somehow embarrass the president.
Part of this, too, is what I call, I don't think insensitively, a privileged death. This is a death of a journalist. And that counts for more with the journalistic community than, you know, the death of a soldier or the death of a child in Syria or other deaths. It's, you know, it's one of their own. And, you know, and they're always on the lookout for that. I understand it, and I understand press freedoms and all that. But, you know, we expect them to make more of this than they would of other deaths. But when you put it in the context you're describing, yeah, it seems to me the world remains the way it is. I wanted to ask you this. Is this an example of the reorientation of foreign policy that Donald Trump has been doing since he's been president? Is this part of America First, thinking of the world in a different way from the way Barack Obama and even perhaps George W. Bush thought of it?
Yes, I think it is. He was, I think President Trump is thinking, okay, at the end of the day, what's good for us? Not what's good for some abstract notion about whether this guy who was a, you know, when we say, I mean, by the way, when we say journalist, the guy writes articles in newspapers, some of which are true and some of which are not true.
Yeah.
He had more the flavor of a political operative than of a journalist.
Well, that's beginning to blend now in lots of contexts, CNN and elsewhere, right? I mean,
right. But in the Middle East, and you know, that part of the world, the difference between a intelligence operator and a journalist and a political revolutionary is near you know zero.
Yeah.
So he was just that. Okay. And so Trump, looking at all those facts, says, okay, this is gruesome, but is it against American interests? And I think Trump thinks he may or may not have been a kind of journalist, but whatever it is it good for us? Or should we destroy 20 years of a relationship because of some abstract notion about killing other human beings? And so I think Trump is just applying common sense to this whole business. And in doing so, I think that's a very healthy way of looking at foreign policy and looking at what really matters in America.
Would it have made any difference if he had expressed himself more unequivocally in his condemnation of the gruesome killing, of the fact that this was not just about money between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, but also about an important strategic alliance and so on?
Well, maybe, but Americans understand money, right?
Yeah, sure.
They understand jobs. They understand, I mean, it's going to be the holiday season here. People like low oil prices so they can buy their kids more toys.
Yep.
So it's worth telling Americans that, yes, this is about money. This is about your economic well-being. I mean, George Bush, after September 11th, almost seamlessly, we continued to work with the Saudis without any clear moral statement of what their role may or may not have been right. in the attacks on September 11th, as if the American people were not intelligent enough or sophisticated enough or even worth telling about such things. And so here comes Trump, and he's going to be honest with them. He's going to speak to the American people as if they were citizens who send their sons and daughters off to fight in our wars, and if they deserve the truth. And for that, he gets lambasted. Yes, it's about money. It should be about the well-being of the American people, and that's just how Trump put it. And that seems to me, you know, the key point here. I mean, the one other piece to add, they keep asking whether or not MBS knew about this, the king in Saudi Arabia, and as if that itself would be grounds for breaking relations. Well, I expect he knew about these things. I would have expected he would have ordered this kind of horrific thing. The same way, you know, President Xi in China orders a bunch of very bad things going on, or Putin, or you name some of these leaders. They order the killing of people at times.
Yeah.
And it's a dangerous world, and President Trump understands it that way.
Yeah. You know, I thought you were going when you mentioned George W. Bush, and what you said was all sound. But I recall the time, I think I have my dates right, where he told people that winter to go shopping.
Yes.
Isn't that right?
He had to.
And I remember a lot of the intellectuals in the establishment was up in arms saying, you know, what should we do? We need to do something. American people need to do something. And criticized George W. Bush for saying, just go shopping. That was an economic argument, too. But people felt something more profound should happen. Yeah, look, I think, you know, again, president can express things a little better, can be a little clearer, a little more emphatic on some things. But the real politic of this, I think, is clear enough. I noticed James Clapper, who's no friend of President Trump, head of the defense DNI under Obama, said, well, you know, it's a gruesome and horrible killing, but can't let this in any serious way affect our important relationship with the Saudis.
Right. And I mean, Clapper is somebody who himself, with Obama, killed quite a few people.
Yeah. Sure.
And, you know, ordered the killing of all sorts of Islamic terrorists.
Yeah.
And he understands that this guy Khashoggi may not have been a gun-carrying Islamic radical, but he was certainly somebody who was not a friend of American interests or Saudi interests or the interests of the West.
All right. Well, good. We'll look for your piece, and we'll alert the audience when it's up. But thank you. Let's move on to the upcoming meeting, economic meeting, I think, in Argentina. I think that's right. And meetings that the president's going to have with President Xi of China. What's at stake here? What's going on? What should he do?
Yeah, no, I think it's going to be an interesting weekend, really. The president has talked about imposing tariffs starting on January 1st. And this will be the last meeting of world leaders before those tariffs take place. And the president reiterated in an interview in the Wall Street Journal this morning that he was not inclined to back off that he sees tariffs as a very useful tool, that he looks forward to meeting with President Xi, but that, you know, they have a long ways to go before they come to some kind of an agreement on, you know, trade relations between the U.S. and China. The president wants systemic reform, and the Chinese don't. And until that happens, I think Trump is going to use tariffs to try to remake the American economy and the world economy. So this will be an interesting weekend to see what China has to say. And you'll see, I think, the president stand up and continue to be as tough as he has been.
He does hold some cards here, right? I mean, he does. There's, of course, American power, American influence, still the greatest economy in the world. But he's got some cards he can play if he decides to.
Yes, absolutely. He knows that the Chinese want to make a deal and be able to trade freely here in the United States. And I think the president believes in free trade, but that's not what's going on. And I think if the president simply got up and, you know, gave a litany of all the trade abuses that were going on, that in itself would be a very useful thing to do. And also the theft of intellectual property by China. if they're doing it to us, they're doing it to other parts of the world too. Yeah. And reiterating that over and over again, the president has actually put us in a stronger moral position than I think we've ever been in when it comes to how to look at our economy in relation to the world economy.
And does he bring up longstanding obligations that China has that they have ignored, neglected, or denied?
Well, I mean, this whole question of their sovereign debt default that the Chinese have hanging over their head, I imagine that may be brought up, probably more likely in private. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of moving pieces with all that. And so it may or may not be brought up. But it's an interesting point that you raise, Bill, because the Chinese are heavying up with all sorts of countries right now. They're lending them money and demanding pretty onerous terms. And when they don't pay, they're really squeezing some of these smaller countries, something the vice president pointed out a few weeks ago. And President Xi bristled it when the vice president, you know, brought up those things. Well, here's China heavying up on all sorts of smaller countries that they're loaning money to, when in fact the Chinese still owe the American people, you know, north of $1 trillion on defaulted sovereign debt that they owe the United States.
Yeah.
And so it's a great time to be examining the economic affairs of nations, because you see that it's not just economics, but it's world politics, and there's something serious going on. Yeah. China is trying to get the world on its side, and the United States is trying to get, you know, the best parts of the world on its side.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a struggle, and so this is not just about dollars and cents. This is about the future of the world for the next 50 years.
Yeah.
Will it be one basically set by China and their economic agenda? Or will it be set by the United States and its drive toward human freedom?
Well, all right, here we've talked about two important theaters of conflict and tension, both of which are important to our future, the situation in the Mideast, the situation with China. And now we have a possible threat, an existential threat, as we call it, on our southern border. It looks to me like when the president was talking about this caravan and, you know, having some bad dudes in it and, you know, making it use the term invasion, he wasn't so far off, was he? Given the events of this past weekend and the attempt to rush the wall there in the southern part of your state, California.
No, that's right. It looks like an invasion, but the invasion itself looked like kind of a political theater, don't you think?
A little bit. Yeah. I mean, was it orchestrated, organized? Yeah, I believe that. If that's what you mean.
Right. And once it became orchestrated, the president took the common sense view that it looks like an invasion. And the mainstream media immediately took the view, not an invasion, you know, a human crisis, refugees, et cetera. Now, in this morning's L.A. Times, the writers, and the L.A. Times is obviously a liberal newspaper, they don't call them refugees. They call them migrants. And honest reporters going down there look at these folks, and they look not like people who are fleeing political repression, but folks who, like many immigrants, just want a better life and want a job.
Yeah.
And the MSNBC reporter last night, I'm not sure if you caught this, but one of the MSNBC reporters in Tijuana, inside that stadium, said, okay, there are families, here they are. But also, the majority of these people are men. They're adult men.
Yeah.
And they're not men. They're not men looking for refugee status. These are people looking for jobs. Now, that's an honest reporter going down there, showing both families, but also the truth, which is that the majority of these people are not refugees.
Yeah.
And in that regard, the president's being vindicated every day.
Yeah.
Quite right.
Yeah. You know, what you choose to show, what you choose to report on, I've been watching some of the media like CNN, where all the pictures are of women and children, and women through translators saying, and my baby was, you know, subject to tear gas and was very, very sad and very painful and very horrible. Switch over to Fox, and there are these guys, you know, storming the walls. So which picture are you going to take? You're reporting on a reporter doing an honest picture, I take it, huh? seeing
on MSNBC of all places.
Of all places, yeah, interesting.
And he actually took his cameraman from the little part of the, he called it the actual center of the stadium where you had your families, to the perimeter where you have all these men.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
the men are the ones who are simply part of an exodus of Central America,
sure,
wanting to get to North America and a better life.
Now, it's interesting to me is two other parties here. One, the mayor of Tijuana, and I guess to some extent some of the government in Mexico, they're running out of patience with these guys there, too. I suppose some of them would be just as happy to see them jump the wall, so they'd be rid of them. But their impatience is interesting and telling, and maybe helpful, maybe constructive, if the president can enlist their aid. The other group is the Democrats, who remain, you know, just mute on this question of what to do. Just exactly what it is. What is your policy? And how many people will you let in? And who will you let in? And in what way? And they have nothing to say here. Do they think that by having nothing to say, they gain political advantage in hopes that more and more of the media will show, you know, the mothers and children and thus bring out sympathy and condemnation of the president? Speak to either or both pieces here.
Yeah, no, I think they are simply appealing to the most radical part of their political base. But if we're honest about this, and we see that they are not refugees, but they're people who are coming for jobs. You know, you see this story on the very same day that GM is closing five different factories,
yeah,
and losing, you know, thousands and thousands of jobs.
Yeah.
What was the number? 15,000 jobs, something
yeah,
like
yeah,
that?
I think so.
Now, those happen in any big economy. You know, there are cycles on production and, you know, the cars that they're getting rid of, you know, people aren't buying, and that's all understandable. But here we have thousands of people trying to cross our border for jobs at the very time we're losing jobs, you know, today. The economy is roaring, you know, jobs are being created. There's a lot of good things going on. But it's not as if we're simply here. The Democratic Party seems to be of the impression that it's okay to transfer the wealth of Americans to other people who are not Americans.
Now, see, here is where I think, tell me if you agree or not, where the president can make and should make an adjustment. He talks about the flood, and what he does most of the time is talk about, if you will, the man-eating fish in the flood, the sharks, the bad guys who are coming across. But the main issue is the flood itself. There will be some bad guys, sure. But the main issue is the flood itself, and the caravan is just an acute version of a chronic problem, right? Which is, you know, people coming, spilling across our borders all the time. Some of them, you know, looking for mischief. Some of them looking, many looking for jobs. Some looking for, you know, security. But you got to have borders anyway, whether they're nice people or not nice people. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely. You know, I think you're absolutely right. The people keep on coming illegally at a time when we have, I mean, what's the number they use for how many people are currently waiting in line to come to the United States? I think the number's about 12 million are actually have made application and are trying to get into the United States.
Yeah, huge.
If we want to make the argument that we need more people for the economy, well, we have 12 million people who are waiting in line who say, we want to be Americans, we speak English, we respect your system of law and order. And, you know, now, if we need people for jobs, let's look first at those people who have said to us, we respect you.
Right. But you don't have to ascribe, you don't have to ascribe evil intentions to justify actions against the flood, right? You don't have to justify evil intentions on the part of this mass of people in order to make sense that you need to keep this mass of people out.
Oh, right. Right.
What I'm saying is there's too much emphasis. There are certainly criminals and bad dudes, no question. There's too much emphasis on that, which obscures the larger problem, which is the large problem, the flood.
Yes. No, I think that's very well said.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, the president, of course, will call some of those people he said were stone cold killers.
Yeah.
Or criminals, one or the other. But you notice that he said to the mayor of Tijuana, that when you see the people waving flags of their home countries,
yeah,
send those people back.
Yeah, sure. There's a good cut. There's a good way to cut right there. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Right, right. But you're totally right. It does obscure the whole problem, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Why do we want these illegal people? If we said we want more people,
yeah,
and Trump is saying, remember, a great big, beautiful wall with a great big, yep, beautiful door.
That's right. That's right.
Why aren't we doing the kind of things that would give us both the wall and the big, beautiful door?
Yeah.
And the Democrats right now are not interested in any of that. But I would say neither have the Republicans been interested in that.
Yeah, no. Good.
You do see a fair amount of criticism of the Republican Congress for not building the border wall.
Absolutely. And deserved. We need to leave it there. But you took us from the Mideast to China, back to our border, all serious matters, all serious issues, and American Strategy Group under your leadership addressing them and addressing them well. And we thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
You're listening to The Bill Bennett Show.
Claude, we get letters. We get stacks and stacks of letters, as Perry Como used to say.
Right.
We get them as emails.
Exactly. Right. Emails instead
of letters.
They're
not made out of a tree.
No, they're not.
but they come from the heart.
Exactly.
We got a couple of really splendid emails, different styles.
All over,
different.
And by the way, they're really pouring in, and so we'll do this every week on the podcast.
Great.
Now we'll
keep
start
them
to just
coming.
Yeah.
Well, what do people do if they want to email them?
Just
what exactly do they
just
do?
Just send an email.
I would be tearing my hair out.
No, you can send emails. You send emails all the time.
I do.
Yeah, to me. I get them all.
Oh, yeah, I guess you do. Okay.
Just send an email to BillBennettPodcast@gmail.com.
BillBennettPodcast@gmail.com.
Yes.
And it'll get there.
Yeah, it'll get there.
It'll get here.
Yeah, we'll read through them and we'll start reading them every week on the podcast.
Now, we heard from our dear friend from old radio days. We heard from Sandy.
Oh, man, Sandy from Linwood.
Linwood, Washington.
I believe so. She didn't specify, but
Oregon, Washington, somewhere out there.
Yeah. So Sandy, you may remember, she called in one Thanksgiving day when we did a show live on Thanksgiving Day.
Uh-huh.
And she shared that she lost her husband, Roy. They had been married for almost 40 years. She used to listen to Morning in America every night when she had a hard time sleeping. And so you were her, the show was her late night. I'm not sure if that's a late night sleeping aid or whether it's comfort and company for the late night.
Three to six. Exactly. She's out there. I don't mean she's out there. I mean, she's out there on the coast.
Yeah, on the coast. Yeah. So, but I think she meant for comfort and uh-huh. kind of. So she chimed in again. And apparently, she couldn't. She wasn't a listener of the podcast. She couldn't find it. But now she says she found the podcast. So it's like having an old friend back. And so she listened to the Thanksgiving podcast in the middle of the night on Thanksgiving, and said she never tried to listen to a podcast, thought it was hard to do, but it's relatively easy, just find it, click, and listen. So she's happy to find the podcast.
There was a very moving part of that.
Absolutely. Yeah, she says she loved having Mrs. Bennett on and hearing the proper etiquette at the Thanksgiving dinner table. She wants Mrs. Bennett to know that she especially likes the handwritten note part, happened to those.
Yes, the hostess would appreciate a handwritten note.
Right.
I believe Mrs. Bennett's comment on that was she has a file, but it's thin.
Yeah, and getting thinner as the years.
And I think this is where she says in general about manners at the table that her work with the inner city children has been more productive.
Oh, best friend's kids got it. Yeah.
But her own sons still works in progress.
What is this? What is it? Profit is...
Profit in your own land.
Yeah. Profit is... Well, I'll summarize. It's appreciated everywhere else except in his own home.
Now, the second email I want you to read, because one of the rules Mrs. Bennett has, and this was, as we'd say in the law, this was kind of bill of attainder. This was a particular provision aimed at me.
I felt as though there were a few. The whole
The tie. Yeah. And you were not helpful to me because she has repeated several times now. Well, one of my rules is, don't eat so you get stuff on your tie. Should Aunt Claude chimed in and said, well, I've rarely had a meal with Dr. Bennett where food stuff didn't end up on his tie.
Correct.
So this is what happens when I leave you and Mrs. Bennett to your own devices.
We start,
supervising either of you, which I have no grounds to do. Anyway, one of the rules is no wine bottles on the floor.
Right.
Right. We keep them on the table. I have been in the past
kept a couple of wine bottles on the floor next to me within reaching distance.
Right. Convenience.
Rather than getting up and going into the kitchen or into the pantry.
And plenty of, you know, wine bottles for others at the table if they want that.
For others, too, but it's next to me.
Right, exactly.
But anyway, so we got a response to that.
Michael Laporte from Long Island, New York.
East Coast, okay.
Yeah, he says, lots of praise for Mrs. Bennett, but just an item of critique. She says, he nearly choked when she mentioned not placing the bottle on the floor. He says his earliest and fondest memory of a Sicilian father was a gallon bottle of Gallo port wine on the floor by his seat.
He says, I used to buy Gallo wine by the gallon. Gallo hearty Burgundy. I wonder if they still have it.
We'll have to see. We'll have to ask Michael about that. We'll check online. And
Michael,
see
Gallo is still selling hearty Burgundy and Burgundy? All right, go ahead.
So he says, when time came at dinner or special occasions to charge the glasses, dear old dad would reach for the jug and acquired skill. In one motion, the heavy jug was retrieved, lifted, and slung over and rested on the shoulder. He says, each glass filled and placed back in its spot on the floor. There simply is no other place for wine. He said, by the way, kids also got wine.
All right, so we'll leave it to Mrs. Bennett to respond to that. I don't know.
Right.
She'll take on the Sicilians.
Yeah.
The old man here had a jug of Gallo next to his chair, and he picked it up, and it's heavy.
Oh, yeah.
Slung it over his shoulder and then poured from there.
There you go.
It's a great picture. Oh. And then we had a request for advice, right?
Yes. Rick Robb in Fort Worth, Texas. He says, Mr. Bennett, I've been an avid listener of your show and now your podcast. Thanks for the insight and discourse with great thinkers you allow us to have access to. He says, my daughter, Christine, is a national merit finalist who is preparing to graduate from the University of Oklahoma with a dual degree, Sooners. You want to talk Sooner football?
Well, a little bit.
Okay.
I think we'll read that Notre Dame email, and then we'll talk a little Sooner football.
You got it. Chemical engineering and finance. Wow. With a 3.8 overall GPA, she now wants to attend law school after scoring a 178 on the most recent LSAT.
178?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, here's Christine, right? 3.8, chemical engineering and finance.
Whoa.
What in the world?
What in the world?
You're doing it right, Mr. Rob in Fort Worth. And she wishes to study intellectual property law. I'm concerned with the liberal bent and bias of many of our top law schools and would appreciate your advice on where you would recommend she attend.
Well, she's going to get into a great law school
because
she's highly qualified, great scores. At 178 is formidable. Rick, if I may, except the fact there are going to be a lot of liberal professors wherever she goes. Probably, I guess, still the most conservative law schools, University of Chicago. Very difficult to get into. Great law school. She may, given the chemical engineering intellectual property, want to think about another fine law school close to you, which is University of Texas. If she's interested in the chemical engineering, oil and gas, intellectual property in that regard, you know, they know oil and gas there very, very well. Otherwise, you know, Harvard, Yale, Chicago, Duke, is she going to run into liberals? Yes, lots of them. That's just the nature of higher education. But I imagine she survived some liberals even in very red Oklahoma. So we wish her well. Well done so far, young lady.
Oh, by the way, Penny checked in. Formerly from Glendale. I think she's in Illinois now. I'm not 100% sure where she is now.
But Penny from Glendale.
Yes. Saturday morning girl. She's checking in. She says, yes, we still are keeping the conversation going. She has a small chat group with us for the girls from Texas.
So, nice.
So they're doing that still.
Nice.
Which is great. Which is great. So we'll hear from Penny. Notre Dame football. This is from Melissa Hartman.
Now, this is a complicated email. I want you to read it carefully.
Okay. She says, good morning, Dr. Bennett. I was listening to the podcast this morning. Like you, I am glued to the TV on Saturdays, the Purdue game. I just prayed for the healing hand of Jesus for Tyler. Anyway, I wanted to chat with you about Notre Dame. Like you, I was not a fan. All the reasons you listed were mine. My daughter is now in her sophomore year at Notre Dame as a biochem major. Oh, these folks are going to school for some pretty big things here.
Yeah.
Okay. Notre Dame was not her first choice, as I was not thrilled that she applied. I'm assuming she's saying Washington University, was her first choice. Talk about the liberal bastion. Yeah. She did not get in and later said that God told her to go to Notre Dame. Well, surprise, surprise, God was right. There is a chapel in her dorm, and they go every Sunday night to the 10 p.m. Mass. Since going to school, she now goes to confession every week. She walks to the grotto regularly to pray with friends and dorm mates. Her prayer life has greatly expanded. She took the bus to the March for Life last year. She spent a summer in service at St. Guyana's, in North Dakota. The administration may not be as devoted as we would like, but they do care for the students and give them every opportunity to grow in their faith. It may be hard to watch the football games, but do you ever get to see the players lead the student body in the alma mater, Notre Dame, our mother, after every game, win or lose? It's great. We even sang it at the volleyball game, I believe is what she meant. Obviously, they sing it all the time, but I never knew that. I'm sure you saw College Game Day and all the signs calling people to Jesus. ESPN, every single person needs Jesus. That's what they had. In closing, I agree 100% with your friend who hopes we lose one. I was so mad last time Alabama played Notre Dame in that game. Notre Dame has no business being there. Georgia should have been there. I'm a Georgia girl. Go Dogs. Sick 'em. Take care and hi to Claude and everyone.
Well, that's a complicated email.
Yes.
But let's start with Sooner football. Oklahoma has one blemish on the record here, and it's against Texas.
And I thought they were going to lose that game against West Virginia, but it ended up...
Right, well, but it was crazy.
56-51 or something ridiculous.
So we'll get into who should be in the fourth spot. Michigan's out, done, finished, disappointing like crazy. But Oklahoma has a better score a lot because they can't defend against anything. right. So there's a problem there. Notre Dame, I got to give it to them. I thought they'd have a tougher game against Syracuse. They rolled over Syracuse. They had a bit of a tough time with USC. Why am I wishing for them to lose? Complicated reasons of my knowledge of Notre Dame and Obama commencement speaker and Gary Wills and a lot of liberal stuff. But, you know, it's a nice email, beautiful, about the kids. I wonder if more kids who go to Notre Dame become more religious as a result of that experience or less religious. Hmm. More Notre Damers can tell me about that. Do they deserve to be in the playoffs? Sure they do. They're unbeaten. Are they going to play? Probably Clemson.
Probably so.
Good luck. Clemson hasn't had a really, really tough game. The toughest game they had, actually, I guess, was pretty close against Pittsburgh, but very close against Texas A&M. Did you see that seven overtime game?
No, right, exactly.
A&M had with LSU. Anyway, anyway, it's too complicated. It would take too long to explain my reasons for antipathy to Notre Dame. But who will be number four? Here's what I predict. I predict it'll be Ohio State. I think Oklahoma may beat my beloved Texas.
Okay.
Who knows? Mm-hmm. Even if they do, I think the fact that they get scored on so much is going to go against them. Assume Alabama beats Georgia. Right. We'll make it easy. If Georgia beats Alabama, they're
Georgia's four, yeah.
And then Alabama's the fourth team.
Correct.
If Alabama beats Georgia, they're out. That's two losses. They lost to LSU. Oklahoma wins, then it's Oklahoma versus Ohio State. Ohio State has a big game against Northwestern. They look so strong, so dominant in that Michigan game.
Right.
I think they get in. And so one seed Alabama will play four seed Ohio State. Wow.
Yeah.
And then number two Clemson play number Notre three Dame. Notre Dame.
Yeah, there you go.
And we'll see. But I would like an answer to my question. Notre Dame listeners, parents or graduates, do you become more or less religious from your experience at Notre Dame? I think it's a fair question. I remember a friend telling me that he was dating a girl who was much younger, who was a graduate of Georgetown. And he said, what's it like to go to a Catholic university? And she said, well, it's not a Catholic university. She did not know it was a Catholic university.
Wow.
Never occurred to her over the period of 4 years. Wow. I guess they removed a lot of the crucifixes from the classrooms and so on. But anyway, something sticks in my throat about these Catholic institutions that they really want to be Catholic or not. Catholic University absolutely wants to be Catholic. Notre Dame, Georgetown, I'm not so sure.
Right.
Okay, we'll get some emails on that. And how do they send an email to me, Claude? Tell me.
Just send an email to Bill. It's a BillBennettPodcast@gmail.com.
BillBennettPodcast@gmail.com.
Exactly. And by the way, there's some big, speaking of Catholic schools, big high school, Catholic high school basketball Saturday coming up this week here in the D.C. area. You've got St. Vincent Pilate and Laurel playing St. John's, Mount St. Joseph's playing Gonzaga.
My alma mater.
Mm-hmm. You've got St. Mary playing DeMatha. It's all at DeMatha. It's starting at 1 p.m. all the way till 8 p.m.
All right, so you going?
10. I'll probably go for a couple games, take Manny. I've got a buddy who's an assistant coach at Pilate, so we'll go support him. And well, once you're in the door for $15, you can stay for all the games. And so
it's a bargain.
I might just end up sitting
down. Can you get a hot dog or something?
Oh, yeah. We'll get plenty of hot dogs. Yeah.
Fries for Manny.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's a big fry guy.
Now, speaking of high schools, I didn't bring it up to Brian Kennedy because I know it's a sore spot, but his high school team, St. John Bosco, ranked number one in the country,
mm-hmm.
lost on the weekend to Mater Dei.
Oh, really?
Another California powerhouse high school. And it was a big surprise loss. And Brian said something to me over the phone, which is very un-Brian-like. Can you imagine the most un-Brian-like thing
what was
Brian
that?
To say? He said, I think I need grief counseling. Well, that does it for today's show. To catch up on previous episodes of the show, go to BillBennettShow.com. You can follow me on Twitter at William J. Bennett, and you can like me on Facebook. Just search Bill Bennett. Feel free to email the show. I'd love to hear from you. It's BillBennettPodcast@gmail.com. Please share the podcast with your family and friends. We'll catch up next week.